Good morning. For the record, my name is Catherine Glinsky. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Scott Collins. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Because the mistrial was necessitated by the law enforcement officer's misconduct, which was either intended to prejudice the defense or indifferent as to that result, retrial after mistrial violated Mr. Collins' right to be free from double jeopardy. And general double jeopardy doesn't bar a retrial after mistrial granted at the defendant's request, but there are exceptions to that rule. Under the federal constitution, retrial is barred where the prosecutor intended to goad the defendant into requesting a mistrial. And the Oregon Supreme Court has held that under the Oregon Constitution, which is more protective than the federal constitution, retrial is barred when improper official conduct is so prejudicial as to require a mistrial, and if the official knows the conduct is improper and either intends or is indifferent to the resulting mistrial.
So are you urging us to apply the federal standard, the Oregon standard, or do both?
I think that the Oregon standard should be applied in Washington.
So you're urging us to adopt the Oregon standard.
I am, yes.
Which the Supreme Court in Hopkins did not do and said it would be, there would be a rare case in which it would.
Right.
And you are arguing this is such a case.
Yes, I am.
Are you also arguing that the Oregon standard encompasses not just prosecutors, or there's a case where it's a bailiff, mm-hmm. but also here the law enforcement officer?
Yes, I am. In Oregon, they say state actors, and they specifically say that's not limited to the prosecution.
So what case law are you relying on that applies the Oregon standard to law enforcement officials?
The case law in Oregon talks about the conduct of the actor. It calls it a state actor, not just prosecution. It does say that.
But are there cases where in Oregon where the court has applied that standard to deputies,
to law enforcement,
police?
I did not find any, and part of the reason is this is a very narrow exception to the federal, standard. It's a very limited application. We do have case law in Oregon that says it's a state actor. They did apply it to a bailiff in a particular case, mm-hmm. and what they did was focus on the actor's conduct. We do have case law, federal and state case law, in other contexts where law enforcement is recognized as a state actor and law enforcement conduct is imputed to this,
but
to the prosecution.
In other contexts, you're not talking about applying
this particular double jeopardy exception. No, it would have to be by analogy.
And
recognizing,
have you cited any of those cases?
I did not cite that in my brief, no. I did rely on the Oregon standard and the Oregon case, which says, this is a state actor that we're talking about. We're not talking about just the prosecutor. We're talking about a state actor who has, by intentional misconduct, prejudiced the defense with the intent to do so, or recklessness as to that result.
So do you concede that under the federal standard there is no double jeopardy violation?
Yeah, I don't think that there is evidence that the prosecutor intended to goad the defendant into this. The prosecutor filed an affidavit saying that he informed the witness of the court's ruling, and just immediately before the witness testified. And the question that he asked wasn't even intended to elicit this information, and that really goes to show the conduct on the part of this witness that this is a law enforcement officer with 40 years of experience. He had just been informed by the prosecutor of the trial court's rulings that we're not going to get into the burglaries, do not talk about that, and yet he did so, and he did so not even in response to the prosecutor's question. It was volunteering this information in order to ensure that the jury knew that he suspected Mr. Collins in a string of burglaries. And so it's that intentional misconduct, it's that intent to prejudice the defense, or at the very least, it's intentional misconduct which was indifferent as to the result to the defense. And because he's a law enforcement officer, he's a state actor, and his conduct does meet this Oregon standard. It's one of those narrowly defined cases that Washington Court and Hobson talked about. It is the right case to apply the Oregon standard. And because of that, the charges that were presented to the jury in this case should be dismissed. Unless that court has questions on the other issues, I would rely on my briefing as to those. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Sean Britton. I am a deputy prosecuting attorney with Cowlitz County and representing the state in this matter. It is our position that the Oregon standard is not applicable in this case and that the court should rely on the federal standard as decided upon by Hobson applying to this mistrial in this case.
Well, I think you should, based on the argument, focus on the Oregon standard and why we should adopt it and why it doesn't apply.
Well, Your Honor, the Oregon standard doesn't apply in this case, as noted by the Hobson court, because the Oregon standard applies to officials. I believe the exact wording is state officials. And in this case, Deputy O'Neill would not be considered a state official. The Hobson court's
Why not?
And actually, if we use the analysis of the Hobson court, which a state fire inspector had violated a motion in limine and testified to impermissible conduct, the Hobson court even noted that applying the Oregon standard to an official is different than applying it to a state employee, a fire inspector. In this case, it wasn't any intentional conduct that the prosecutors had done at the trial level, but it was an act by an officer in either misinterpreting or just simply ignoring the prosecutor's instructions as to what to discuss and what not to discuss. The other issue, Your Honor, is the conduct by Deputy O'Neill in his testimony was, from the onset, seemed prejudicial. However, we do note that there had been two and a half days of arguments on motion in limine. The defense counsel had wanted to discuss this issue of other suspects' evidence. And as the record later shows after upon retrial, that they actually did argue other suspects and blaming the defendant's son for this conduct. Deputy O'Neill later testified that he did in fact suspect the defendant's son of also being involved in these crimes. But the exact testimony that was objected to was Deputy O'Neill said, "I informed him that I had a suspect in a string of burglaries, and that's when it stopped." There was no specific statement that Deputy O'Neill suspected the defendant himself, that he just had a suspect. We know later that the defendant's son, who they wanted to blame for these acts, resided with the defendant. And it was to be noted in our briefing, this argument could have actually been beneficial to the defense counsel had either a curative instruction been applied or Deputy O'Neill had simply been permitted to continue testifying because he did in fact suspect somebody other than the defendant of committing these crimes. So even under the Oregon standard where the conduct has to be so prejudicial that only a mistrial can cure it, a limiting instruction, a curative instruction, or simply allowing the defense counsel to argue the other suspect's evidence could have also cured this issue that was presented to the court. The other issue, Your Honor, is that...
You're saying in this case, are you disagreeing with the ruling granting the mistrial?
Well, Your Honor, I just think that there was no other option given to the court.
Did you oppose it in the trial court?
There was co-counsel involved in this case.
There was a motion for a mistrial. All I want to know is when there was a motion for the mistrial, did the state oppose it?
The state did not oppose it at that time, Your Honor.
So presumably that was a position that was taken in good faith. You didn't not oppose it just so you could come here later and say the judge screwed up by granting it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So if you didn't oppose it, then I assume the reason you didn't oppose it is because it was warranted under the law. If it was warranted under the law, then it wouldn't have been something that could have been cured just by a curative instruction or some other lesser remedy, because judges only impose mistrials when there is no lesser remedy.
Your Honor, I agree. I'm also just suggesting to the court as well that had further discussion or insight been done at the trial level, both by the prosecution, the defense, and the court, there could have been an alternative option taken. Unfortunately, that was never expressed to the court. It was never considered by the parties involved. But it is something that should possibly be taken into consideration, given that the Oregon standard does rely on the fact that only a mistrial can cure this improper conduct. And looking back at this case, there could have been alternative options had the parties involved actually looked at them.
Well, but that I think the point is that's target gone by. If I could ask you to, because time is short, address the two other issues just so that I'm clear. It's my understanding that there were 8 counts of possession of stolen property, and the state concedes that all but one of the 8 convictions should be vacated because there's a single unit of prosecution.
Yes, in doing the research for this case, Your Honor, there is one case on point out of, I believe, Division 3 in McReynolds that indicates that multiple counts of possession of stolen property is one unit of prosecution under the statute. It's the state's position that the based on that and no other contradicting case law, there's 2 counts of possession of stolen property, and I believe 5 or 6 counts of possession of stolen property in the third degree. Under the McReynolds case, yes, that would have to be one unit of prosecution. It has an interesting effect of when there's been multiple victims of possession of stolen property and having a value of under $750, thereby forcing the state to aggregate into one count, causing felony charges rather than misdemeanor counts. That's an interesting effect that I don't know if the McReynolds court actually considered. There's one single count of possession of a stolen vehicle, which...
Well, so I assume that that's an interesting issue that the trial court will have to grapple with when it goes back.
Potentially, yes, Your Honor. On the other hand, the state recognizes that these cases, these charges, the sentence does not... The offender's court does not affect the actual sentencing of the case itself. That relies on the firearms that were later sentenced.
And then let's turn to that issue. And the argument is that the sentence violated the constitutional prohibition against cruel punishment. And it's my understanding that the argument is looking at the sentences in the aggregate. And under the case law, as a general rule, we don't look at the cumulative sentences. We look at the individual sentences.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so my question is, do we need to engage in an analysis of the Fain factors?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because...
And if not, why not?
In this case, Your Honor, we have a specific statutory language which dictates to the court how to sentence firearm offenders under these specific circumstances. We have actually 2 statutes which deal specifically with firearms crimes being considered unlawful possession of a firearm, possession of a stolen firearm, and theft of a firearm have to be run consecutive to each other. We have legislative intent, which clearly dictates why these statutes were enacted in this manner. And on top of that, we have a case interpreting this exact same factual scenario in which the Division II Court of Appeals indicated that when there's been multiple counts, multiple firearms for purposes of sentence, the actual sentence itself, they are each to be run consecutive.
Which case is that?
That would be the Murphy case from 1999 out of Division II. It is the in that case a burglary occurred in which I believe five stolen firearms occurred. The defendant was charged with unlawful possession of a firearm in a second degree and theft in the firearm for second degree, 10 total counts. And the Court of Appeals overruled the trial court and dictated that each firearm offense was to be run consecutive, but purposes of offender score, they had the same offender score, and I believe in this case was a 1, but they each were to be run consecutive, and they clearly noted that although this may seem improper or unfair, it's up to the legislature to address unintended consequences from their sentencing structure. In this case, the legislature specifically said they want to punish criminals that have firearms so severely that it makes it not, the sentence not worth actually possessing the firearm.
So your position is this, the trial court had no choice but to impose consecutive sentences.
Yes, it's under the specific guidelines of the statute and the legislative intent behind the statutes. There was quite a bit of argument at the trial court level about this exact issue, but there was nothing brought to the trial court that would suggest that its reading of 994A589(1)(c) and 941040 subsection 6 allowed any other option other than running consecutive sentences.
And that's consecutive sentences for which crimes?
Unlawful possession of a firearm in the first degree, which is counts 1, 2, and 3, and possession of stolen firearms, I think it's 14, 15, and 16.
Thank you.
Thank you.